just so besotted with the idea of having a sister.
Well, half-sister.
I didn't realize the value of my mother. Our mother. Until she was gone.
Well, from the stories I've heard today, she was cheap while she was here.
Well, this can grow up to about 20 centimetres long and weighs about 150 grams.
What is it? Jesus.
It's a switchblade knife.
By the measurements you gave, I thought it was a dick.
A knife can do more damage.
Shows how much you know.
Fortis Fortuna Paduvat.
Fortune favours the brave.
The Scum Manifesto. The Society for Cutting Up Men.
Society for Cutting Up Men.
Feminists are women. Women owning their power.
You don't want an explanation?
Not really. I guess I'm happy for you, or I'm sorry I happened to you.
Educated?
Yes.
Do you intend to pursue further study?
I've been studying the works of Valerie Solanas.
The Scum Manifesto.
Yes, you've heard of it.
Well, it doesn't sound like a typical feminist. That sounds like a stereotypical feminist. Nothing but anti-men and anti-motherhood propaganda.
But she was my whore.
What does that make me then?
He'll always be my little boy.
Then why are you so threatened by me?
Because he hasn't learned to say no to you yet.
If you love him, you'll forgive him.
Why?
Because, after all, he's just a man.
That's the trailer for the Switchblade Sisterhood. Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Cinema Australia podcast. My name is Matthew Eales. My guests on this episode are the Switchblade Sisterhood writer, director, producer and cinematographer Dave O'Hardy and actor Kieran Hudson, who makes his feature film debut as lead actor in this film. Regular listeners of the Cinema Australia podcast will know that Davo is no stranger here. This is Davo's third time as a guest, and it's always a pleasure to hear from Davo as his career progresses. The Switchblade Sisterhood follows a young woman grieving the death of her mother, discovering she has a half-sister, bearing a grudge over their late mother's abandonment of her. The two take solace in exploring the deceased's belongings, where they find a book on radical second-wave feminism and a literal switchblade, both of which are used as weapons of choice in a bitter rivalry about fractured families, gender roles, and personal, contemporary, and intergenerational politics. The Switchblade Sisterhood is available to watch now via DaveOhardyFilms.com, where you can also find Davo's previous films, including features and shorts, some of which we discuss here as well. Anyway, enjoy. Davo, Kieran, thank you for joining the Cinema Australia podcast. It's great to have you both with us.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Thanks so much for having us.
Congratulations on the Switchblade Sisterhood. During a time of superhero fatigue and box office lures like Godzilla and Kong and Madam Web and, you know, films like that, the Switchblade Sisterhood is a welcome escape from most of the dross that the big end of Hollywood is churning out at the moment. So congratulations again on this one. You both should be very proud.
I'm sure we are. I was going to ask all the Marvel actors to get involved, but they were otherwise busy. But I think making this what we call a kitchen sink drama is a refreshing thing for the audiences, as you've said.
Yes. Kieran, are you into those kind of films? Do you watch many Marvel films or these big Hollywood blockbusters?
I do, yes, indeed. I am actually looking forward to going to see Madam Web eventually. But I've heard mixed reviews about it here and there, so going into it hesitatingly, but with an open mind.
Yes, that's right. That's right. And, you know, we bag out some of these, you know, bigger budget films, but they are a guilty pleasure for everyone, and everyone's allowed to enjoy and watch whatever they want to. But yeah, as I said, you know, this film is a bit of an escape from those kind of movies. Davo, the last time we spoke was ahead of the release of your last film, Public Eye. How was that experience for you once the film was out there in the world? I mean, because I speak to you prior to the film's being released, but what was it like afterwards? How was that experience for you?
I was apprehensive with Public Eye just because of the content of it, but also very in my element. It was something that I really wanted to do and felt very empowered and very supported to do. So it was making that step from making films with other people in mind to this one is on my own bucket list. So upon actually getting it out there and having it released worldwide and having those accolades, the awards from it, the notoriety, the reviews and so on, it was just because it was so embraced, I felt embraced. And so going into the films to follow it, like Switchblade, gave me a really good sense of competency of I've found my voice as a filmmaker, and I have good people around me who also share my vision. So that was this great milestone moment.
Yeah, and in between Public Eye and Switchblade, you have kept busy because you made a short film called Desire Ability. Was that was done in between these two, right? Can you tell us about that one?
For sure. Desire Ability was kind of out of nowhere. It was just my friend Matthew Archibald and I have been mates for about 10 years or so, and he's profoundly deaf. He has cerebral palsy, and he's just a big ball of energy, a big ball of great life attitude. I've never heard him complain about any part of his life or existence. He's such a get-up-and-go kind of guy. So being a mate of mine for so long, I wanted to honour what a good impact he's had on me as a friend and what inspiration he was when I was making a film like A Silent Agreement, which was about deaf characters. So I made this little piece on him. It's more of a documentary on his ideal relationships and his sexuality and all these things that he wouldn't normally have a chance to discuss nor really make public. But he's like, one thing that people don't realize about people with multiple severe disabilities is that we still have these needs for relationships and for companionship and so on. So I made this documentary with kind of like cutaways to what he's talking about, what he envisages as the perfect partner. And that too was just really well received. People really got the humanity of that. And because we've been friends for so long, it was just me being able to honor him as a person.
Yeah, wonderful. Where can people see it?
Also, with it's on my website, www.davohardyfilms.com. It's all up there. That was around the time of making Public Eye, I set up my own streaming website just because, as I'm sure a lot of indie filmmakers will realize, you get your films onto a platform, it's there for a certain amount of time before it runs out, before it expires, before it gets pushed out by new content. So I decided early on to just be in charge of my own distribution, which has helped with the rights to other content in it, like music and so on, because it's not it isn't being written that it's in perpetuity wherever it goes. It's as long as it stays within certain parameters. So as long as it stays within my control, it's easier to control. So that's where all my stuff now ends up.
Yeah, that's very interesting. It's an interesting little side part of the story that you're telling there, and I'm sure a lot of the independent filmmakers who listen to this will take a lot away from that. But I am wondering, how long after Public Eye did you get to work on the Switchblade Sisterhood? Is it something that you started immediately? Were you working on it prior to Public Eye? When did this one come about?
I think the germination of it predated Public Eye, as a lot of the work I'm doing now has been in development or as just a bubbling idea for quite some time. I don't know quite when, but the idea of Public Eye, Switchblade, I should say, began as a moment between two characters. One leans over the other's shoulder at the end of whatever the story is, just whispering something assuring in their ear. And I thought, that's a nice way to end a movie. What's the preceding 2 hours going to be about? So that just sat there for a very long time. And then when all the pieces of this one came together, pulled that little note out and thought, that's how I want to end the film. I want to end it with a gentle over-the-shoulder reassurance.
Yes.
And then kind of work backwards from there.
Wow.
But again, riding the wave of what Public Eye was as a filmmaker and as a an artist, I felt so in control to do something like this.
Yes, yeah. Kieran, you played a role in Public Eye. I was looking last night. You were credited as Teenage Boy. Before I ask you about working on this film and working with Davo, I want to know a bit more about your journey as an actor. Where did it all start for you? Because your on-screen work so far has only been in these two Davo films. Is that right?
That is correct, yes. I mainly got my start doing amateur theatre. I've always wanted to be an actor since I was a wee little lad, since I was about two-ish or so, standing in the cinema, dancing to the films on set on screen, like The Jungle Book and The Lion King. You can ask my parents, they've always seen that actors sparkle. And me and them said, yeah, he's going to want to do this. And I've always stuck to my guns. And over the years doing theatre, Devo and I finally clicked, and we started developing work from there.
It's very interesting that you talk about your theatre work there, because while I was watching this film, I did kind of keep connecting this film with a theatre production. It kind of has a very, a theatre kind of style about it. But how did you first meet Devo? Where did that introduction come about?
I met Devo doing writing for a theatre production of Yentl, the Yeshiva Boy. And we slowly but surely started talking. I said, oh, hey, got a little bit of extra work if you want to get involved with that. I said, oh, sure, why not? And I remember we were at the same audition for another production, and he saw I could hold a pretty good performance, and he said, hey, I have a film in the works. Would you like to be a part of it? And I said, oh, what's the film called? The Switchblade Sisterhood. And I guess the rest is history.
While we were doing Yentl, it was at the time, the first time it had been put on stage since the Barbra Streisand film came out. So it was this big occasion about it. And I just really liked seeing Kieran work with the company, because it was officially, they weren't certain who would be doing what role behind the scenes, basically. Who would be on sound, who would be on lighting. And Kieran, who was, I think, 20 at the time, was so in command of what he was doing. There was, as is always the case on theatre, behind the scenes, there was some drama with the company. And he really stepped up, walked into the room very humbly and said, all drama aside, we're here to do this. I'm here for this. I'm with you. And I really liked that maturity in him. That really struck me. And so, as he said, when we were both auditioning for Cuckoo's Nest to follow that, him playing this other role of one of the patients, and it was this really intense part, I thought, this man has dimension to him and depth. Must talk to him more.
I'm really glad that you two found each other here, because again, while I was watching this film, I kept thinking, what a revelation Kieran is here. His performance is so good in the Switchblade Sisterhood. What was it like to work with Kieran on film, rather than a theatre environment?
It was interesting on day one, because you can get yourself very in your own head prior to getting a film made. I'm sure Kieran did a lot of work on the character and how he would portray him. He was very eager to get about doing it, then realized how slow going making a film is, how yes. many times the same thing has to be shot again and again. And as we have to point out, it's not you, it's something else. It's a lighting thing. It's the camera on the dolly was a bit too jangly. I had to go back to square one again. Just this stop start mentality and having to bring it up every time. I think that was a bit of a wake-up call on the early morning of day one.
Yes, yeah, I bet. I've been on film sets before, and there's a lot of just sitting around and waiting around between takes.
It didn't help this was a dawn shoot on day one, which we'd been there the night before, so we were there for daybreak. So I'm sure there's a bit of sleep deprivation and uncomfortability already involved, but you wouldn't know in the finished product, so well done to you, Kieran.
Yes, yes. And Kieran, before we get into talking about this actual role and this character itself, can you tell us a bit about working with Davo as a filmmaker?
Working with Davo was very comfortable. He definitely showed us how he worked, and how he works is being very in tune with his actors, understanding our boundaries, and understanding that there are lines that we won't necessarily cross. And he's respectful with that. He's respectful of those lines. And he's always willing to challenge us as performers and say how we can mold a shot, because we weren't necessarily comfortable with whatever was being shown. It's like, okay, cool, we'll move on from that and we'll do it in another direction. He was very open-minded and always willing and eager to make things as professional and bluntly caring on set.
You've had that theatre experience and that theatre background. Is there a difference between directors when one's working on in theatre compared to film? Is there something that stands out for you as a difference?
In a sense of the phrase, yes. Film directors, from what I'm experienced with when it comes to university projects here and there, they're a bit more, okay, we're done, let's move on. Whereas with theatre directors, they will hone in on a particular line for days, if not weeks on end. Mm-hmm. Even if you're like, I've got this line down. It's like, no, we need to find the crux of it all. And yeah, that can get suffocating. But at the same time, it makes sense as to why they're doing it.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, of course. Davo, at the beginning there, you mentioned that this is a film about feminism written by, a white guy. Tell us about the idea for the Switchblade Sisterhood. Where did this one come from? Has it been brewing in you for a while, or is it a relatively fresh idea for you?
It's a big patchwork of things. So what I wanted to do was do my usual family drama with a lot of comedy involved to break the tension. That's the scaffolding of it. I worked then outwards from that, which was the relationships between the main girl, Brianna, and her father, and then her relationship with Kieran's character, and built that little web out and created the coming of age character. That's what is the arc of the story. Moving around that, giving it more richness and dimension. What is she having her coming of age about? And it's through grief, it's through her transition into womanhood, it's all these things happening all at once at a key point in her life. And I came across the title of Switchblade Sisterhood, and I thought, that's a really good title. What can I do with that? And I thought, well, I'll incorporate a switchblade in there somewhere, and then did the research and found that switchblades as an item are contraband in the country. And having to go through all of the red tape to even have a fake one made for the film, and just all that great behind the scenes junk that one has to go through. But there's still a piece missing. And I asked a friend of mine, Sonia, who I've worked with a few times. She's a very academic woman who, when I was telling her about these ideas, and I gave her the title of Switchblade Sisterhood, there's a film from the 1970s which is called The Switchblade Sisters, also called The Jezebel, depending on the release of it. And it's an exploitation film about a gang of young women who have switchblade knives, and how they are at that time, at the height of the second wave feminism, they're giving men their comeuppance. That's the basic plot of it. And I saw this film and thought, that's a good idea. I wouldn't quite put it as a David Hardy idea, but it's in the realm of what I'm going for. Yeah. I then sat down with Sonia and told her about these pieces and said, there's just something missing from the ingredients. What can it be? She gives me this kind of like knowing curt smile, reaches over and pulls out this tiny little book called This Gun Manifesto and says, here, read this if you can manage it. And this book is written in the late 60s, early 70s by Valerie Solanas. And it's just this really intense work on radical feminism. Mm-hmm. depending on how you read it, it can be read as very man-hating dogma. It can also be seen as a satire of the time, and just it's all in the mind it goes into. I found it to be a very easy humorous read, but in there it's like saying to have the power that we're entitled to, women need to throw off the chains of the workforce, go into looting, send all men into exile, only use them for our needs. Or procreation will be done in test tubes and just so on and so forth. It's this really extreme view. Mm. But I thought, wouldn't it be funny if this Brianna character is latching onto this idea, not because she believes it per se, but because it's her last link to her deceased mother. And I thought, well, that's the emotional thing there. That's what she's really going up against.
Yeah.
And that's the coming of age. So that's how it all came together.
Yeah, I'm glad that you mentioned the satire there, because there is quite a bit of satire in this film as well, isn't there?
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. Do you enjoy writing that?
It was good fun. It's always fun as a writer to do both sides of a heated argument, because you got to believe each person's part. Yeah. But there's this, I think it's like 10-minute long sequence of Kieran and the actor having their argument, and it just goes on and on and on, because we're effectively just pulling up the last eons of the Battle of the Sexes. So they're having their men are this, women are this sort of thing back and forth, and it's all meant to be taken as a satire. It isn't actually our opinion, but it was good fun to write, for sure.
Yeah. And I do have some questions about that that long 10-minute scene that you're talking about there. But before I get into that, Kieran, did you feel a connection to this story or this character, or was it just a matter of being able to work with Davo and turning up to perform? What kind of connection there did you have with this character?
It was a bit of both, actually, but I would feel that Jonathan was very sweet. He's a very sweet boy, very good boy, has this untapped potential in him that is being kind of hindered by his affluent upbringing, particularly being stifled by his mother, and he has some things to work through. And I think that definitely drew me towards him, because in my mind, an actor has an aspect of their character in themselves. The director and the writer have seen that. That's why they've cast you in the role. It's now your job to find where that character lies in you. And I definitely found that as a bit of a challenge to myself. I'm like, how can I play Jonathan the best that I know how?
Mm.
And that kind of drew me towards him.
Yeah, that's very interesting to hear you say that. It's a rather large character ensemble, this film. There's a lot going on between a lot of different characters. Davo, are these the most amount of characters that you've ever written for a film? I was trying to think back last night. This certainly seems like the biggest.
I want to say there were more characters in Public Eye, but the ones in Switchblade are definitely more fleshed out, and with greater shades of grey in them. There's a lot of archetypes in Public Eye, but there's a lot of character development within those dimensions of these characters for this film.
Mm. Talk to us a bit about balancing so many characters throughout the writing process. Was that a welcome challenge for you?
Yes. A lot of it was beginning with archetypes and then making them stand out. So there's been some criticism of the characters that, oh, the father's too young, or just stuff for casting, or all the men in this film are total douchebags or just not desirable. And it's like each male character is an archetype of what goes into making a complete human being, as all the female characters are also. So there's no flawless character who has themselves together. Everyone is a very flawed character, but you have the hippy dippy father, you've got the aggressive DV other father of the other girl, and the bloke who plays Kieran, or Jonathan's dad, is a very affluent, very good father, but he's a bit of a businessman, so he's this whole other economy in himself. So once I found why I was writing these characters and what they represented, it was easier to balance them. but I was also very aware of not making more characters than the story could sustain, because then it would just be a very long list, like a phone book, basically.
I'm just going back to you saying about that criticism there of, you know, the father's being so young. Why did you decide to cast so young?
I hope Seton can't hear this. He's actually not that young. He's pushing 40. So we had a moment on set where basically Seton, who has no kids of his own, I don't know if he intends to have any, but that's his own thing. He kind of looked at me being like, you know, it just hit me. I am old enough to have an 18-year-old child.
Yes.
That would be, that is very possible.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It's just because he looks after himself. He doesn't have kids. Maybe that's part of it. He looks quite young, but love Seton dearly. He is old enough to have a child that's that old. And I think that was really helpful with his character, is that making the character of Martin, who is this very airy fairy character, his idea of parenting is, oh, you're having a bad day, sweetheart. Okay, well, let's read your tarot and we can go from there. More of it to get her to open up. But because he has this very laid back idea of life, well, maybe that's just coming through in his presentation. Yeah. But you can't always tell that from an audience point of view.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Kieran, there's a lot of dialogue here for you to work with. There's a lot going on. How did you handle some of the longer monologue scenes? Talk to, you know, our actor listeners a bit about preparing for those longer scenes.
I would say, coming from a classical background, being theatre trained, it definitely helped me have this knowledge of understanding that you need to break down a scene and break down your lines line by line, go through each one, understand where your motives are, where your objectives are, how you're delivering certain lines, and where your character lies within the story. Why are they saying this? Why is it reactionary? Is it a cue line? Is it something that your character believes wholeheartedly? And why is it being said the way it is? Why is it in the script? In a sense, I kind of relate to this old theater mantra, which is mise en scène, which means everything has its scene. Mm-hmm. This Chekhov's gun, as it were. Always find the Chekhov's gun in every line you say. That would be my biggest advice to younger actors or actors who aren't really sure how to go about doing line rehearsal. Find the Chekhov's gun.
You're listening to the Cinema Australia podcast on SoundCloud, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or at cinemaaustralia.com.au.
Davo, you mentioned this 10-minute scene earlier. I want you two, both of you, to you know, break the fourth wall here and really tell us about shooting that big scene, because it is a major part of this film. Kieran, maybe we can start with you. Talk to us a bit about shooting that particular scene. It's quite an intense scene, actually, as a viewer. You know, you're right on edge and you can't look away. You can't stop listening to what each one of them are saying. I found myself trying to decide whose side am I on here. So I'd love you both to, you know, to talk us through shooting that particular scene from a technical point of view.
It was a long day. I'll say that. It was a very long day. We were on set for, I think, from 7 a.m. until 2:30 in the morning. It was a long day. And the thing with the scene was, it was one continuous shot, like different angles, but one continuous shot. So we would have to redo it over and over again. And I think what hit me in the face as a newer screen actor is that screen fatigue is a definite thing. It appears and it will hit you like a rocket when you least expect it. And David was very respectful of that, and we took our time and ultimately realized that I had burnt out, so I needed to go reset, and then we did it another day, which was a headache and a half, but it was definitely something as a learning curve for myself to find time in the day to vegetate and just let thoughts and this time dissipate and then reconnect and go about doing the show again. But it was a good scene. It was a very good scene, and it was incredible to shoot. It was a really, as I said, incredible shot.
when you are taking that break and you are stepping away from it, do you still stay in character or do you let it all go?
In a sense, I kind of stay in the same zone that you were in as a character, but at the same time, you need to remember as an actor that you have an anchor. Okay, you are not your character, you are your actor, you are yourself first and foremost, and you need to hold true to yourself and find your anchor, grab hold of it, and then breathe, like lean against it if you need to. Like still be in the same headspace as your character, but remember you are you first and foremost. Yeah. I think that is a big thing that our actors don't do, is let go.
Mm-hmm. The scene is a two-piece. It's a two-hander scene. Do you work closely with British, your co-star in this scene, to get through it all? How closely do you two work together to develop this moment?
We worked a quite vigorously amount. We actually did a theatre rehearsal, quite a few of them actually, mm-hmm. trying to pinpoint the good moments, like, early on, even before we began filming, David will sit us down and go, okay, let's do the scene. And then, like, for example, there's a moment in the scene where she goes, there, right there. That's exactly what I'm talking about. Just a click of her fingers. David caught onto that early. It's like, okay, we need that for the scene. That is the kind of projection that we're giving. Finding those moments early on, before the cameras even begin rolling, before we're even on location, is incredible. Finding those nuanced niche moments that's where in my mind the magic comes from. Mm-hmm. I think it was very good that we sat down and thoroughly worked through it so vigorously.
Yeah, and Dave, I'm sure you've got a more technical perspective on shooting this scene. Can you talk us through that?
Yes. So because a lot of my work back in the early days also began with theatre, so I would put a lot of my early film ideas into a short platform for short players and then see how they go as a storytelling thing and then branch them out into feature screenplays. Mm. So I was writing this as, what is this film about? What's the central conflict? And I wrote this basically as a one act, one scene play to have these two characters move around the room. That's the idea. So yes. they're just kind of going in a circle as they talk in circles, effectively going over the history of the rise of feminism and of human rights and so on, but in a very condensed and aggressive form. So it was just a way to keep them moving, keep the scene moving, and to allow the energy of what they're saying to keep building, which is why from the early stages of rehearsal, I'm like, run it as a stage piece. Mm. If you need a line, I'll feed it to you, but don't stop. Keep it going, because I wanted them to effectively wear themselves out.
Yes.
So that was great fun. Technically speaking, it was done in the location. Kieran gave the long hours of the day, mainly because we were away on location shooting this. So we were down the Kangaroo Valley. We were hours from Sydney and in this location, and our day started very early. But the shooting of it was quite late at night because it normally needed to be dark to shoot these things.
Yeah.
So we'd spent all day rehearsing, shooting other things, and then this. And I was just like, we're going for a take, and I'm at this angle in this corner. I'll shoot it all from here, and I'll go to this corner next and this corner next, and I'll have all the coverage I need, go. And like troopers, they went through it again and again, and we did it probably two takes per angle, but it was a 10-minute scene. So after a few takes, they were starting to feel it.
Yes.
And the choreography of hitting each spot never – most of the time they would hit the same spot, but sometimes they'd be a little faster, a little slower, and it was just getting – the continuity of it going then.
Yeah.
But there were troopers and we got it in the can, and it works out well. But I swear to God, editing that scene together, it was Just tidal waves of aggression. It was great.
Yeah. Yes, I bet, I bet. Sometimes I can be accused of looking too deeply into a scene and, getting things entirely wrong when I overthink them. But something that I did notice in this scene was, you know, this argument that they're having is constantly going around in a circle. The light coverings are a circle. The table's a circle. They're constantly moving around and around. I don't know if that played into it at all, but that's something that I picked up
absolutely
there.
It did, yes.
Yeah.
That was all.
Am I right there?
Intentional things. Yeah, for sure, for sure.
Oh, that's exciting. Usually I'm told I'm wrong.
But even down to like the colors of the balloons in the background, everything is just so muted because they're taking up all the space. But the scene ends with them having a bit of a stalemate, and he says, "You want me to be a man? You're at my 21st birthday party in the Arts of Society. I only became a man tonight." And he points to this enormous happy birthday thing on the wall. Mm. And so in her half victory, half defeat, she just kind of snarls at him, "Happy birthday then." It's that subtlety of writing on top of what we're actually hitting the audience over the head with that makes it such a cathartic and enjoyable, exhausting scene.
Yes, yes. There's another great little piece of dialogue in that scene towards the end where he says to her, "I just realized how cute you are." And she says, "I just realized how acutely fucked you are." I love that line. Dabo, you shot this film, and as far as I can tell, this is your first feature film where you're credited as the cinematographer. What made you decide to take on this role?
I think the more I go through making films, the less I want to be doing everything, even delegating to other people to do a lot of the post stuff. I'm so barely involved in the post process. I'm still there as a director in a decision making sense, and I'm there for it all, but I'm not hands in it from the ground up kind of thing. I get people to do the assembly ad, the assembly editing, and so on. But with the cine of it, I was at a point where I thought, well, this is a cost-cutting measure, and this is a project I can be on the camera more, because I'm, as an actor, I'm barely in this thing. I've only got like maybe three short scenes, yes, and they're really just being the voice of reason. I have a tiny little part in this film, but being there as a director, when I was getting the location set up, like this one in Kangaroo Valley, I thought, well, look, if I'm on camera, that's one less person to bust down there and accommodate. So let's rough it. So it was a good mix between yet another full feature, but also a bit of a throwback to those early days of filmmaking when it was me and my mates being together for a weekend saying, let's make a movie this weekend. And upon wrapping the film, we just collapse in a heap saying, it's done, but it's the best type of exhaustion. So it was great.
Kieran, there's a lot of challenges involved in making an independent film, I'm sure, but there is a scene in the film where you're required to sing and play the guitar. Was that really you playing and singing? Are you a guitarist, or talk us through that one?
It was me singing, yes, but unfortunately it was not me playing guitar. That was by the talented Linford Gilmore. He is an amazing guitarist, and his talent shines through then some and forever and always. And he definitely took the reins when I was trying to sing and play guitar at the same time and just wasn't coming off the way that we wanted it to. There's like, hang back, you were hired because you can sing nicely and you can say pretty words. I'll play the strings for you. So thank you.
Which I will say is because Kieran can play the guitar and he can sing, just at the same time, in front of a camera, in front of the cast and crew, it was a bit of a, oh, this is a lot all of a sudden. And we thought, well, what's the element we can save him from having to do right now? And having Linford there with a second guitar in the same tuning, he's like, I gotcha. So he provided the backing track effectively.
Yes, yeah. Kieran, was there any more that you wanted to add to that?
No, not really. I would just say that I take my hat off to them for 1,000%.
Yes. I guess we can't really talk about this film without talking about some of the other performances there. We did say earlier that it is a huge ensemble piece, and
yes.
Another actor that really stood out for me during my viewing of this film was Catherine Thompson. This is another great performance by another newcomer. As far as I can tell, this is Catherine's first film as well. Kieran, can you... Davo, can you tell us a bit about working with Catherine and casting her here, as well as some of the other actors?
Yes. Catherine, was a great find. She also has a very strong theatre background. She's a part of the Australian Theatre for Young People, ATYP, and she's a very solid actor on stage. This was her first major film piece, and when she rocked up to the audition, she felt that she had flubbed it. She did her piece and then kind of backed away, saying, "Well, thanks for your time. I'm sorry I didn't quite get what you wanted, but thank you all the same." I stood up saying, "Like, no, that was great. Could you do it again with this kind of direction?"
Yeah.
So I think she was quite stunned by that, but what I found was her resonance and her conviction in character was flawless, no notes. I liked that she is such a tiny, sweet person, and then going to the character, she's a ball of blades and fire. She is really aggressive, which isn't her actual personality at all, but she was really enjoying that transformation into the character and how she expresses herself. There's a moment in the film where she completely loses it, has this huge tantrum and trashes the room.
Yeah.
And when she read that in the script, she's like, "Do I actually have to do this?" I'm like, you are in fact going to trash a room for this fun, yeah? And we choreographed that into its life, and we shot it in one shot, one take, with four or five different cameras going. But I think that for any actor is always a dream, just to go in and create havoc knowing that It's all for the camera, baby. Go for it.
Yes. Kieran, it sounds like a lot of actors involved in this film do come from a theatre background. Was that did that make things easier for you to be working with actors with that kind of background?
It definitely was, yes. It made things a lot easier because it allowed me as an actor to go, right, these are my people. They understand my thought process, understand my background going into this, and it definitely made me feel more comfortable performing alongside them. I would definitely say that, as interesting as it is to say, I would think that a lot of screen actors would benefit from a bit of theater training, because it grounds you just a bit more, and you find find the magic in the performances a lot more on screen, on stage, than you do on screen. As on screen, you can kind of say, cut, let's do a retake. But on stage, if something happens, you run with it. You keep going until that scene is finished, until the curtains close. Then you deal with it. Yeah. And that is something that I find spectacular.
Yeah, a lot of actors who I've spoken to who do have theatre backgrounds say the same thing. And I think it's great advice for, young actors out there who are looking to get into the industry. Davo, speaking of acting and performances, you're in this film like you are in most of your films, or all of your films, actually. But this is an extremely different look for you. Was it your idea to alter your appearance so obviously?
Oh, dear God. Okay, so my character in Switchblade has this beautiful head of hair.
Yes.
I'm over 30 now, and I've had a very stressful life as a filmmaker, and it's time to show. Over the last 10 years, I've watched my own hairline recede, because that's just genetics and a life well lived. But I wanted my character to look a little less haggard, so I gave him this beautiful rug. And I thought, well, this is probably the last chance I'll have to really pull that off and look like it's mine. So thanks for picking up on that, Matt. it was also a chance for me as an actor just to have that experience of really stepping into another physical person. I didn't quite do a Meryl Streep. I didn't get lost in Reese's DNA, but it was nice to between takes be moving hair from my eyes, because I haven't had a fringe like that in 15 years. But it's it was another one of those bucket list things of like, what's something I want to do in my film career? I would like to have a full head of hair. Thank you.
Yeah, for a nanosecond there, I thought to myself, geez, that guy's got a great head of hair. And then I realized it was a wig, and then I realized it was you.
Thank you, Matt. I appreciate that.
There's something a little bit more serious here. And, Dave, I'm not asking you this question lightly, you know, but I've seen a lot of movies with a lot of drugs featured in them. You know, there's been countless amount of films. But something that is really rare to see on screen is, you know, somebody sniffing petrol or sniffing spray paint, you know, within a domestic kind of environment. Why did you want to feature paint and petrol sniffing as the major drug here?
It's something that one doesn't think of right away. People think it's either shooting up or smoking or something else or other, and that's quite understood within the general society lexicon of drug taking. But because spray paints and other aerosols are fairly accessible, that's why they're behind grills at your local Bunnings, for example. That's why. Because they are so accessible and they are so potent. And I've come across people in my own life who have used that recreationally. The petrol sniffing, it's even more accessible. You go down to your local corner service station and get a liter of the stuff for next to nothing. It's just another form of inhalant, and it causes hallucinations and so on. But I just wanted to show that there's nothing glamorous about this. Yeah. And it was another way of showing a very dark part of the character, but also giving the audience pause. I had people at the premiere who are just that never crossed their mind that one could get high off of petrol fumes ongoing and really have that be an addiction for them. Mm. A lot of people kind of like the scent of gasoline, I suppose, but the idea of huffing it every day, it was like, who would do that? You'd be surprised. Mm. And it was just a way to kind of educate without being too heavy-handed.
Mm-hmm. Kieran, as far as your performance goes, I'm wondering, did Davo give you any reference films here to watch ahead of the making of this film?
In a sense of phrase, not really, but he kind of put me towards characters who were going into a situation that wasn't necessarily under their control. One character that I kind of related to in the back of my mind is from an old book called The Outsiders, that character being Ponyboy. He definitely had that kind of glimmer of not really sure where he fit in the world. So he found this kind of environment that fit him in a sense, but it wasn't what he realized it would be. And I think that was a big takeaway with Jonathan, is that he was in over his head. And I tried to project that a bit, especially when Lacey snaps and their stabbing occurs. That was a bit of a big Atmos day, no dialogue for myself, but it was a lot of reaction and understanding that Jonathan is in a situation that he cannot get out of, because who knows what she'll do next.
Yes. Yeah.
As it were.
Yeah. Guys, thank you very much for, you know, sharing those stories about the making of the Switchblade Sisterhood. I can't thank you enough for sharing these stories with us, and I know that our listeners will love hearing them as well. But before we wrap things up here, Davo, you're celebrating 10 years of Complex, a short film you made early in your career. I'm just wondering, how do you reflect on that film now? You know, how do you look back on it, and do you have any plans for, you know, celebrating this 10-year anniversary?
Well, yeah. Like a lot of my early work, I would tend to approach it with this isn't in the same ballpark as to what I can do now. I wouldn't want to show it to someone just finding out about me and saying this is my best work, because it's not. But it was the gift that keeps on giving. It was the film that I made, which was without a competition in mind, a festival in mind. It was just by me, for me, basically. And it just had legs, and it had gone running. And so 10 years later, it was the first film I did that got put onto a platform back when it was so hard to do so. And it got me a bit of a following of all things, and it got my name out there. So it's been revived as a short play. It's always doing good sales on my website, and it's just been this thing that just keeps on going. So now we've reached 10 years of that. So similar to my making of Desirability with Matt Archibald, bringing the film that brought me so much complex, the film about two flatmates, and one of them is a nudist, and he didn't tell his flatmate. It's all just hilarity from that point. We're bringing it to both the stage again, and with a remastered release of the film for this festival called Qtopia, which is a queer collective of artists here in Sydney. And they've been very supportive of kind of celebrating the film itself and the career that it helped to springboard. So that's a really good time for this to be happening.
Oh, wonderful. That's so good to hear. You know, all these years later, it's still one of my favorite Dave O'Hardy films. So, you know, I love to hear that it's had this. What's that? Sorry.
Thank you.
Oh, no worries. Kieran, now that you've had this experience working on a feature film, are you keen to make more now? Or do you want to jump straight back into another film?
Give me the next script, my good sir. I am ready. I'm willing and ready. Today we were actually talking about new projects that might be developing in the stratosphere that is Dave O'Hardy's films, one of which I have created and am helping Dave go through the editing process of. I can't give too much information away, but I can say that it is an Australian-based war miniseries set in 2014. That's what I can really say.
Wow, how exciting. Anything that you two work on next, I'm sure people will be anticipating. So I'm looking forward to hearing more about that or anything else that you've got going on, actually. But I've got one final question here, and it's a question that I ask all my podcast guests. And I know, Dave, I've thrown you off a few times with this one, and Kieran, my apologies if I throw you off with it as well. But have either of you seen any Australian films lately that have stood out for you? I mean, this is an Australian film podcast. I'd love to know if you've watched anything lately that you've really enjoyed.
I would say two things I've recently watched was Danny and Michael Filippo's Talk to Me.
Yes,
that
yes.
film has been doing incredibly at the Actors. Good job with both of them. They've done wonders. I remember watching them on YouTube with their YouTube channel Raka Raka when I was younger, and I just thought there's something about this too. They're nuts, they're wacky, but they are incredible directors, and they've been doing incredibly the entire time. Talk to Me, it was an incredible film. It really was. Garner in the sequel, which I am very much looking forward to seeing. And then with that in mind, also Baz Luhrmann's re-release of Australia as Faraway Downs.
Yes.
An absolutely amazing series. Sitting down and watching that, recapturing the magic that was Australia with more content was incredible to watch. And it was definitely showing me that, yes, This is a Baz Luhrmann work. Like, if you've seen Moulin Rouge or Elvis, definitely a Baz Luhrmann film and series, but incredible nevertheless.
Oh, Kieran, that's wonderful to hear someone give Baz Luhrmann some praise, because I'm a huge Baz Luhrmann fan, but people do love to hate him sometimes. So, you know, to hear someone give that series in particular praise, it's so good to hear. Dave-O, how about you?
I was blanking on the title, but yes, Talk to Me, because I've just finished watching all the things in the most recent actor festival that I saw a lot of Aussie films kind of back to back, and was just blanking on what is that one that swept up at the awards, and Talk to Me. What I liked about that is similar to the Academy in America, they don't tend to give genre films a lot of the awards. It's usually the biopics or the things that can be boiled down into one moment or one really big set piece. But for that, it was a showcase of ambition and of what can happen when everyone's on the same page and working towards a common goal. Yeah. So I hear a lot of hate for Australian independent films, even the ones which are backed will still be independent because of the amount of numbers involved. Mm-hmm. But when you see something that just succeeds and it does so well, that's very gratifying. Another friend of mine had a film in this year's actors, Ronnie Scala, who had Streets of Colour. And seeing him make that film from its early days to its release to going all the way to the actors, getting a nomination and going right up to that finish line, just seeing people who I know personally find their success in this industry is what keeps me in it, because it can be very disheartening to see just the same people at the top getting their accolades. But when you see someone really climbing to the top, as Ronnie has done, as the people behind Talk To Me have done, it really makes these communities work and makes things like Cinema Australia about it's at all levels of our industry, top and bottom. We're all working in the same things with the same goal in mind.
Yeah, that's an incredibly positive note to finish this on. Kieran and Davo, thank you very much for joining the Cinema Australia podcast. It's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you both.
Always a pleasure. I'll be back with you very shortly for the next film, I'm sure.
Thank you so much, Matt. You are a gem.
Thanks for listening. Find all the latest Australian film news at cinemaaustralia.com.au. You can follow Cinema Australia on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, YouTube, and TikTok.